Nichols, Henri said. They are already watching us. You are a girl, and a pretty one at that. No one would suspect you.
Isabel didn't hesitate. I'll do it.
The men started to thank her. Henri silenced them. The printer is risking his life by writing these tracts, and someone is risking his or her life by typing them. We are risking our lives by bringing them here. But you, Isabel, you are the one who will be caught distributing them, if you are caught. Make no mistake, this is not chalking a V on a poster. This is punishable by death.
I won't get caught, she said.
Henri smiled at that. How old are you?
Almost 19.
Ah, he said. And how can one so young hide this from her family?
My family is not the problem, Isabel said. They pay no attention to me. But there's a German soldier billeted at my house, and I would have to break curfew.
It will not be easy. I understand if you are afraid. Henri began to turn away. Isabel snatched the papers back from him.
I said I'd do it.
Isabel was elated. For the first time since the armistice, she wasn't completely alone in her need to do something for France. The men told her about dozens of groups like theirs throughout the country, mounting a resistance to follow de Gaulle. The more they talked, the more excited she became at the prospect of joining them. Oh, she knew she should be afraid, they told her often enough. But it was ridiculous. The Germans threatening death for handing out a few pieces of paper. She could talk her way out of it if she were caught. She was sure of it. Not that she would get caught. How many times had she sneaked out of a locked school or boarded a train without a ticket or talked her way out of trouble? Her beauty had always made it easy for her to break rules without reprisal.
When we have more, how will we contact you? Henri asked as he opened the door to let her leave.
She glanced down the street.
The apartment above Madame Lafoy's hat shop, is it still vacant?
Henri nodded.
Open the curtains when you have papers. I'll come by as soon as I can.
Knock four times. If we don't answer, walk away, he said.
After a pause, he added,
Be careful, Isabel.
He shut the door between them. Alone again, she looked down at her basket. Settled under a red and white checked linen cloth were the tracts. On top lay the butcher paper wrapped ham hocks. It wasn't much of a camouflage. She would need to figure out something better. She walked down the alley and turned onto a busy street. The sky was darkening. She'd been with the men all day. The shops were closing up. The only people milling about were German soldiers and the few women who'd chosen to keep them company. The cafe tables out on the street were full of uniformed men, eating the best food, drinking the best wines. It took every ounce of nerve she had to walk slowly. The minute she was out of town, she started to run. As she neared the airfield, she was sweating and out of breath, but she didn't slow. She ran all the way into her yard. With the gate clattering shut behind her, she bent forward, gasping hard, holding the stitch in her side, trying to catch her breath.
Mademoiselle Rossignol, are you en fait?
Isabel snapped upright. Captain Beck appeared beside her. Had he been there before her?
Captain, she said, working hard to still the racing of her heart. A convoy went past. I rushed to get out of their way.
A convoy? I didn't see that.
It was a while back, and I am silly sometimes. I lost track of time talking to a friend and, well...
She gave him her prettiest smile and patted her butchered hair as if it mattered to her that she looked nice for him.
How were the queues today?
Interminable.
Please, allow me to carry your basket inside.
She looked down at her basket, saw the tiniest white paper corner visible under the linen cloth.
No, I...
Ah, I insist. We are gentlemen, you know.
His long, well-manicured fingers closed around the willow handle. As he turned toward the house, She remained at his side.
I saw a large group gathering at the town hall this afternoon. What are the Vichy police doing here?
Ah, nothing to concern you.
He waited at the front door for her to open it. She fumbled nervously with the center-mounted knob, turned it, and opened the door. Although he had every right to go in at will, he waited to be invited in as if he were a guest.
Isabel, is that you? Where have you been?
Vianne rose from the divan.
The queues were awful today.
Sophie popped up from the floor by the fireplace, where she'd been playing with Bébé.
What did you get today?
Hem hocks, Isabel said, glancing worriedly at the basket in Beck's hand.
That's all? Vianne said sharply. What about the cooking oil?
Sophie sank back to the rug on the floor, clearly disappointed.
I will put the hocks in the pantry, Isabel said, reaching for the basket.
Please, allow me, Beck said.
He was staring at Isabel, watching her closely, or maybe it only felt like that. Vianne lit a candle and handed it to Isabel.
Don't waste it. Hurry.
Beck was very gallant as he walked through the shadowy kitchen and opened the door to the cellar. Isabel went down first, lighting the way. The wooden steps creaked beneath her feet until she stepped down onto the hard-packed dirt floor and into the subterranean chill. The wooden shelves seemed to close in around them as Beck came up beside her. The candle flame sent light gamboling in front of them. She tried to still the trembling in her hand as she reached for the paper-wrapped ham hocks. She placed them on the shelf beside their dwindling supplies.
Bring up 3 potatoes and a turnip,
Vianne called down. Isabel jumped a little at the sound.
You seem nervous, Beck said. Is that the right word, mademoiselle?
The candle sputtered between them.
There were lots of dogs in town today.
The Gestapo. They love their shepherds. There is no reason for this to concern you.
I am afraid of big dogs. I was bitten once as a child.
Beck gave her a smile that was stretched out of shape by the light.
Don't look at the basket.
But it was too late. She saw a little more of the hidden papers sticking out. She forced a smile.
You know us girls, scared of everything.
That is not how I would describe you, mademoiselle.
She reached carefully for the basket and tugged it from his grasp. Without breaking eye contact, she set the basket on the shelf, beyond the candle's light. When it was there, in the dark, she finally released her breath. They stared at each other in uncomfortable silence. Beck nodded.
And now I must away. I have only come here to pick up some papers for a meeting tonight.
He turned back to the steps and began climbing them. Isabel followed the captain up the narrow stairs. When she emerged into the kitchen, Vianne was standing there with her arms crossed, frowning.
Where are the potatoes and a turnip?
Vianne asked.
I forgot.
Vianne sighed.
Go, she said. Get them.
Isabel turned and went back into the cellar. After she'd gathered up the potatoes and turnip, she went to the basket, lifted the candle to expose the basket to light. There it was, the tiny white triangle of paper peeking out. She quickly withdrew the papers from the basket and shoved them into her panty girdle. Feeling the papers against her skin, she went upstairs, smiling. At supper, Isabel sat with her sister and niece, eating watery soup and day-old bread, trying to think of something to say, but nothing came to her. Sophie, who seemed not to notice, rambled on, telling one story after another. Isabel tapped her foot nervously, listening for the sound of a motorcycle approaching the house, for the clatter of German jackboots on the walkway out front, for a sharp, impersonal knock at the door. Her gaze kept cutting to the kitchen and the cellar door.
You're acting very strangely tonight, Vianne said.
Isabel ignored her sister's observation. When the meal was finally over, Isabel popped out of her seat and said,
I'll do the dishes, V. Why don't you and Sophie finish your game of checkers?
You'll do the dishes?
Vianne said. giving Isabel a suspicious look.
Come on, I've offered before, Isabel said.
Not in my memory. Isabel gathered the empty soup bowls and utensils. She had offered only to keep busy, to do something with her hands. Afterward, Isabel could find nothing to do. The night dragged on. Vianne and Sophie and Isabel played Belote. But Isabel couldn't concentrate, she was so nervous and excited. She made some lame excuse and quit the game early, pretending to be tired. In her upstairs bedroom, she lay atop the blankets, fully dressed, waiting. It was past midnight when she heard Beck return. She heard him enter the yard, then she smelled the smoke from his cigarette drift up. Later, he came into the house, clomping around in his boots, but by 1 o'clock, everything was quiet again. Still she waited. At 4 a.m., she got out of bed and dressed in a heavy worsted knit black sweater and plaid tweed skirt. She ripped a seam open in her summer weight coat and slid the papers inside. Then she put the coat on, tying the belt at her waist. She slipped the ration cards in her front pocket. On the way downstairs, she winced at every creak of sound. It seemed to take forever to get to the front door, more than forever, but finally she was there, opening it quietly, closing it behind her. The early morning was cold and black. Somewhere a bird called out, his slumber probably disturbed by the opening of the door. She breathed in the scent of roses and was overcome by how ordinary it seemed in this moment. From here, there would be no turning back. She walked to the still broken gate, glancing back often at the blacked-out house, expecting Beck to be there, arms crossed, booted feet in a warrior's stance, watching her. But she was alone. Her first stop was Rachel's house. There were almost no mail deliveries these days, but women like Rachel, whose men were gone, checked their letterboxes each day, hoping against hope that the mail would bring them news. Isabel reached inside her coat, felt for the slit in the silk lining, and pulled out a single piece of paper. In one movement, she opened the letterbox and slid the paper inside and quietly shut the lid. Out on the road again, she looked around and saw no one. She had done it! Her second stop was Old Man Rivet's farm. He was a communist through and through, a man of the revolution, and he'd lost a son at the front. By the time she gave away her last tract, she felt invincible. It was just past dawn. Pale sunlight gilded the limestone buildings in town. She was the first woman to queue up outside the shop this morning, and because of that, she got her full ration of butter, 150 grams for the month, 2/3 of a cup. A treasure. Chapter 11. Every day that long hot summer, Vianne woke to a list of chores. She, along with Sophie and Isabel, replanted and expanded the garden and converted a pair of old bookcases into rabbit hutches. She used chicken wire to enclose the pergola. Now the most romantic place on the property stank of manure. Manure they collected for their garden. She took in wash from the farmer down the road, Old Man Rivet, in exchange for feed. The only time she really relaxed and felt like herself was on Sunday mornings when she took Sophie to church. Isabel refused to attend Mass, and then had coffee with Rachel, sitting in the shade of her backyard, just two best friends talking, laughing, joking. Sometimes Isabel joined them, but she was more likely to play with the children than talk with the women, which was fine with Vianne. Her chores were necessary, of course, a new way of preparing for a winter that seemed far away, but would arrive like an unwanted guest on the worst possible day. More importantly, it kept Vianne's mind occupied. When she was working in her garden, or boiling strawberries for preserves, or pickling cucumbers, she wasn't thinking of Antoine and how long it had been since she'd heard from him. It was the uncertainty that gnawed at her. Was he a prisoner of war? Was he wounded somewhere? Dead? Or would she look up one day and see him walking up this road, smiling? Missing him, longing for him, worrying about him. Those were her nighttime journeys. In a world now laden with bad news and silence, the one bit of good news was that Captain Beck had spent much of the summer away on one campaign or another. In his absence, the household settled into a routine of sorts. Isabel did all that was asked of her without complaint. It was October now, and chilly. Vianne found herself distracted as she walked home from school with Sophie. She could feel that one of her heels was coming loose, and it made her slightly unsteady. Her black kidskin Oxfords weren't made for the kind of everyday use to which they'd been put in the past few months. The sole was beginning to pull away at the toe, which often caused her to trip. The worry about replacing things like shoes was never far away. A ration card did not mean there were shoes or food to be bought. Vianne kept one hand on Sophie's shoulder, both to steady her gait and to keep her daughter close. There were Nazi soldiers everywhere, riding in lorries and on motorcycles with machine gun-mounted sidecars. They marched in the square, their voices raised in triumphant song. A military lorry honked at them, and they moved farther onto the sidewalk as a convoy rumbled past. More Nazis.
"Is that Tante Isabel?" Sophie asked.
Vianne glanced in the direction of Sophie's finger. Sure enough, Isabel was coming out of an alley, clutching her basket. She looked furtive, was the only word that came to mind. Furtive. At that, a dozen little pieces clicked into place. Tiny incongruities became a pattern. Isabel had often left Le Jardin in the wee hours of the morning, much earlier than necessary. She had dozens of long-winded excuses for absences that Vianne had barely cared about. Heels that broke, hats that flew off in the wind and had to be chased down, a dog that frightened her and blocked her way. Was she sneaking out to be with a boy?
"Tante Isabel!"
Sophie cried out. Without waiting for a reply or permission, Sophie darted into the street. She dodged a trio of German soldiers who were tossing a ball back and forth.
"Merde," Vianne muttered.
"Pardon,"
she said, ducking around the soldiers and striding across the cobblestone street.
"What did you get today?"
she heard Sophie ask Isabel as her daughter reached into the willow basket. Isabel slapped Sophie's hand, hard. Sophie yelped and drew her hand back.
"Isabel,"
Vianne said harshly.
"What's wrong with you?"
Isabel had the good grace to blush.
"I am sorry. It's just that I'm tired. I've been in queues all day. And for what? A veal jelly bone with barely any meat on it and a tin of milk. It's disheartening. Still, I shouldn't be rude. I'm sorry, Soph."
"Perhaps if you didn't sneak out so early in the morning, you wouldn't be tired," Vianne said.
"I'm not sneaking out," Isabel said. "I'm going to the shops for food. I thought you wanted that of me. And by the way, we need a bicycle. These walks to town on bad shoes are killing me."
Vianne wished she knew her sister well enough to read the look in her eyes. Was it guilt? Or worry? Or defiance? If she didn't know better, she'd say it was pride. Sophie linked arms with Isabel as the three of them set off for home. Vianne studiously ignored the changes to Karivo, the Nazis taking up so much space, the posters on the limestone walls, the new anti-Jewish tracts were sickening, and the red and black swastika flags hanging above doorways and from balconies. People had begun to leave Karivo, abandoning their homes to the Germans. The rumor was that they were going to the free zone, but no one knew for sure. Shops closed and didn't reopen. She heard footsteps coming up behind her and said evenly,
"Let's walk faster."
"Madame Mauriac, if I may interrupt."
"Good Lord, is he following you?"
Isabel muttered. Vianne slowly turned around.
"Herr Captain," she said.
People in the street watched Vian closely, eyes narrowed in disapproval.
I wanted to say that I will be late tonight and will, sorrowfully, not be there for supper, Beck said.
How terrible,
Isabel said in a voice as sweet and bitter as burnt caramel. Vian tried to smile, but really, she didn't know why he'd stopped her.
I will save you something.
Nine, you are most kind.
He fell silent. Vian did the same. Finally, Isabel sighed heavily.
We are on our way home, Herr Captain.
Is there something I can do for you, Herr Captain? Said Vian.
Beck moved closer.
I know how worried you have been about your husband, so I did some checking.
Oh.
It is not fine news. I am sorrowful to report. Your husband, Antoine Moyag, has been captured along with many of your townsmen. He is in a prisoner of war camp.
He handed her a list of names and a stack of official postcards.
He shall not be coming home.
Vian barely remembered leaving town. She knew Isabel was beside her, holding her upright, urging her to put one foot in front of the other, and that Sophie was beside her, chirping out questions as sharp as fish hooks.
What is a prisoner of war? What did Herr Captain mean that Papa would not be coming home? Never?
Vian knew when they'd arrived home because the scents of her garden greeted her, welcomed her. She blinked, feeling a little like someone who had just wakened from a coma to find the world impossibly changed.
Sophie,
Isabel said firmly,
go make your mother a cup of coffee. Open a tin of milk. But...
Go, Isabel said. When Sophie was gone, Isabel turned to Vian, cupped her face with cold hands.
He'll be all right.
Vian felt as if she were breaking apart, bit by bit, losing blood and bone as she stood here, contemplating something she had studiously avoided thinking about, a life without him. She started to shiver. Her teeth chattered.
Come inside for coffee,
Isabel said. Into the house? Their house? His ghost would be everywhere in there. A dent in the divan where he sat to read. The hook that held his coat. And the bed. She shook her head, wishing she could cry, but there were no tears in her. This news had emptied her. She couldn't even breathe. Suddenly, all she could think about was the sweater of his that she was wearing. She started to strip out of her clothes, tearing off the coat and the vest, ignoring Isabel shouted,
No!
As she yanked the sweater over her head and buried her face in the soft wool, trying to smell him in the yarn, his favorite soap, him. But there was nothing but her own smell. She lowered the bunched-up sweater from her face and stared down at it, trying to remember the last time he'd worn it. She picked at a loose thread, and it unraveled in her hand, became a squiggly coil of wine-colored yarn. She bit it off and tied a knot to save the rest of the sleeve. Yarn was precious these days. These days. When the world was at war and everything was scarce and your husband was gone.
I don't know how to be on my own.
What do you mean? We were on our own for years. From the moment Maman died.
Vian blinked. Her sister's words sounded a little jumbled, as if they were running on the wrong speed.
You were alone, she said.
I never was. I met Antoine when I was 14, and got pregnant at 16, and married him when I was barely 17. Papa gave me this house to get rid of me. So you see, I've never been on my own. That's why you're so strong, and I'm... not.
You will have to be, Isabel said. For Sophie.
Vian drew in a breath. And there it was. The reason she couldn't eat a bowl of arsenic or throw herself in front of a train. She took the short coil of crooked yarn and tied it to an apple tree branch. The burgundy color stood out against the green and brown. Now, each day in her garden, and when she walked to her gate, and when she picked apples, she would pass this branch and see this bit of yarn and think of Antoine. Each time she would pray, to him and to God, "Come home."
"Come," Isabel said, putting an arm around Vianne, pulling her close.
Inside, the house echoed the voice of a man who wasn't there. Vianne stood outside Rachel's stone cottage. Overhead, the sky was the color of smoke on this cold, late afternoon. The leaves of the trees, marigold and tangerine and scarlet, were just beginning to darken around the edges. Soon they would drop to the ground. Vianne stared at the door, wishing she didn't need to be here. But she had read the names Beck had given her. Marc de Champlain was also listed. When she finally found the courage to knock, Rachel answered almost instantly, wearing an old house dress and sagging woolen stockings. A cardigan sweater hung askew, buttoned incorrectly. It gave her an odd, tilted look.
"Vianne, come in. Sarah and I were just making a rice pudding. It's mostly water and gelatin, of course, but I used a bit of milk."
Vianne managed a smile. She let her friend sweep her into the kitchen and pour her a cup of the bitter ersatz coffee. That was all they could get. Vianne was remarking on the rice pudding. What she even said, she didn't know. When Rachel turned and asked,
"What's wrong?"
Vianne stared at her friend. She wanted to be the strong one, for once, but she couldn't stop the tears that filled her eyes.
"Stay in the kitchen," Rachel said to Sarah. "If you hear your brother wake up, get him."
"You," she said to Vianne,
"come with me."
She took Vianne by the arm and guided her through the small salon and into Rachel's bedroom. Vianne sat on the bed and looked up at her friend. Silently, she held out the list of names she'd gotten from Beck.
"They're prisoners of war, Rachel. Antoine and Marc and all the others. They won't be coming home."
3 days later, on a frosty Saturday morning, Vianne stood in her classroom and stared out at the group of women seated in desks that were too small for them. They looked tired and a little wary. No one felt comfortable gathering these days. It was never clear exactly how far verboten extended into conversations about the war, and besides that, the women of Karivaux were exhausted. They spent their days standing in line for insufficient quantities of foods, and when they weren't in line, they were foraging the countryside or trying to sell their dancing shoes or a silk scarf for enough money to buy a loaf of good bread. In the back of the room, tucked into the corner, Sophie and Sarah were leaning against each other, knees drawn up, reading books. Rachel moved her sleeping son from one shoulder to the other and closed the door of the classroom.
"Thank you all for coming. I know how difficult it is these days to do anything more than the absolutely necessary."
There was a murmuring of agreement among the women.
"Why are we here?" Madame Fournier asked tiredly.
Vianne stepped forward. She had never felt completely comfortable around some of the women, many of whom had disliked Vianne when she moved here at 14. When Vianne had caught Antoine, the best-looking young man in town, they'd liked her even less. Those days were long past, of course, and now Vianne was friendly with these women and taught their children and frequented their shops. But even so, the pains of adolescence left a residue of discomfort.
"I have received a list of French prisoners of war from Karivaux. I am sorry, terribly sorry to tell you that your husband's, and mine and Rachel's, are on the list. I am told they will not be coming home."
She paused, allowing the women to react. Grief and loss transformed the faces around her. Vianne knew the pain mirrored her own. Even so, it was difficult to watch, and she found her eyes misting again. Rachel stepped close, took her hand.
"I got us postcards," Vianne said. "Official ones, so we can write to our men."
How did you get so many postcards?
Madame Fournier asked, wiping her eyes.
She asked her German for a favor, said Hélène Rouelle, the baker's wife.
I did not, and he's not my German, Vian said. He's a soldier who has requisitioned my home. Should I just let the Germans have Le Jardin? Just walk away and have nothing? Every house or hotel in town with a spare room has been taken by them. I am not special in this.
More tusking and murmurs. Some women nodded, others shook their heads.
I would have killed myself before I let one of them move into my house, Hélène said.
Would you, Hélène? Would you really?
Vian said.
And would you kill your children first or throw them into the street to survive on their own?
Hélène looked away.
They have taken over my hotel, a woman said, and they are gentlemen for the most part. A bit crude, perhaps, wasteful.
Gentlemen, Hélène spat the word.
We are pigs to the slaughter. You will see, pigs who put up no fight at all.
I haven't seen you at my butcher shop recently, Madame Fournier said to Vian in a judgmental voice.
My sister goes for me, Vian said.
She knew this was the point of their disapproval. They were afraid that Vian would get, and take, special privileges that they would be denied.
I would not take food or anything from the enemy.
She felt suddenly as if she were back in school, being bullied by the popular girls.
Vian is trying to help,
Rachel said sternly enough to shut them up. She took the postcards from Vian and began handing them out. Vian took a seat and stared down at her own blank postcard. She heard the chicken scratching of other pencils on other postcards, and slowly she began to write.
My beloved Antoine, we are well. Sophie is thriving, and even with so many chores, we found some time this summer to spend by the river. I think of you with every breath and pray you are well. Do not worry about us and come home. Je t'aime, Antoine.
Her lettering was so small she wondered if he would even be able to read it, or if he would get it, or if he was alive. For God's sake, she was crying. Rachel moved in beside her, laid a hand on her shoulder.
We all feel it, she said quietly.
Moments later, the women rose one by one. Wordlessly, they shuffled forward and gave Vian their postcards.
Don't let them hurt your feelings, Rachel said. They're just scared. I'm scared too, Vian said.
Rachel pressed her postcard to her chest. Her fingers splayed across the small square of paper, as if she needed to touch each corner.
How can we not be?
Afterward, when they returned to Le Jardin, Beck's motorcycle with the machine gun-mounted sidecar was parked in the grass outside the gate. Rachel turned to her.
Do you want us to come in with you?
Vian appreciated the worry in Rachel's gaze, and she knew that if she asked for help, she would get it. But how was she to be helped?
No, merci, we are fine. He has probably forgotten something and will soon leave again. He is rarely here these days.
Where is Isabel?
A good question. She sneaks out every Friday morning before the sunrise.
She leaned closer, whispered,
I think she is meeting a boy.
Good for her.
To that, Vian had no answer.
Will he mail the postcards for us?
Rachel asked.
I hope so.
Vian stared at her friend a moment longer. Then she said,
Well, we will know soon enough,
and led Sophie into the house. Once inside, she instructed Sophie to go upstairs to read. Her daughter was used to such directives, and she didn't mind. Vian tried to keep her daughter and Beck separated as much as possible. He was seated at the dining room table with papers spread out in front of him. At her entrance, he looked up. A drop of ink fell from the tip of his fountain pen, landed in a blue starburst on the white sheet of paper in front of him.
Madame, most excellent. I am pleased you are returned.
She moved forward cautiously, holding the packet of postcards tightly. They'd been tied up with a scrap of twine.
I have some postcards here, written by friends in town, to our husbands, but we don't know where to send them. I hoped perhaps you could help us.
She shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other, feeling acutely vulnerable.
Of course, madame. I would be pleased to do this favor for you, although it will take much time and research to accomplish.
He rose politely.
As it happens, I am now concocting a list for my superiors at the Kommandantur. They need to know the names of some of the teachers at your school.
Oh, she said, uncertain as to why he would tell her this. He never spoke of his work. Of course, they didn't speak often about anything.
Jews, communists, homosexuals, Freemasons, Jehovah's Witnesses. Do you know these people?
I am Catholic, Herr Captain, as you know. We do not speak of such things at school. I hardly know who are homosexuals and Freemasons at any rate.
Ah, so you know the others.
I don't understand.
I am unclear. My pardons. I would appreciate it most sternly if you would let me know the names of the teachers in your school who are Jewish or communist.
Why do you need their names?
It is clerical, merely. You know us Germans. We are list makers.
He smiled and pulled a chair out for her. Vianne stared down at the blank paper on the table, then at the postcards in her hand. If Antoine received one, he might write back. She might know at last if he was alive.
This is not secret information, Herr Captain. Anyone can give you these names.
He moved in close to her.
With some effort, madam, I believe I can find your husband's address and mail a package for you also. Would this be sanguine?
Sanguine is not the right word, Herr Captain. You mean to ask me if it would be all right?
She was stalling, and she knew it. Worse, she was pretty sure that he knew it.
Ah, thank you so much for tutoring me in your beautiful language. My apologies.
He offered her a pen.
Do not worry, madame. It is clerical, merely.
Vianne wanted to say that she wouldn't write down any names. But what would be the point? It was easy enough for him to get this information in town. Everyone knew whose names belonged on the list, and Beck could throw her out of her own house for such a defiance. And what would she do then? She sat down and picked up the pen and began to write down names. It wasn't until the end of the list that she paused and lifted the pen tip from the paper.
I'm done,
she said in a soft voice.
You have forgotten your friend.
Did I?
Surely you meant to be accurate.
She bit her lip nervously and looked down at the list of names. She was certain suddenly that she shouldn't have done this. But what choice did she have? He was in control of her home. What would happen if she defied him? Slowly, feeling sick to her stomach, she wrote the last name on the list. Rachel de Champlain. Chapter 12. On a particularly cold morning in late November, Vianne woke with tears on her cheeks. She had been dreaming about Antoine again. With a sigh, she eased out of bed, taking care not to waken Sophie. Vianne had slept fully dressed, wearing a woolen vest, a long-sleeved sweater, woolen stockings, a pair of flannel pants, Antoine's cut down to fit her, and a knit cap and mittens. It wasn't even Christmas, and already layering had become de rigueur. She added a cardigan, and still she was cold. She burrowed her mittened hands into the slit at the foot of the mattress and withdrew the leather pouch Antoine had left for her. Not much money remained in it. Soon they would have to live on her teaching salary alone. She returned the money. Counting it had become an obsession since the weather turned cold, and went downstairs. There was never enough of anything anymore. The pipes froze at night, and so there was no water until midday. Vian had taken to leaving buckets full of water positioned near the stove and fireplaces for washing. Gas and electricity were scarce, as was money to pay for them, so she was miserly with both. The flames on her stove were so low it barely boiled water. They rarely turned on the lights. She made a fire and then wrapped herself in a heavy eiderdown and sat on the divan. Beside her was a bag of yarn that she'd collected by pulling apart one of her old sweaters. She was making Sophie a scarf for Christmas, and these early morning hours were the only time she could find. With only the creaking of the house for company, she focused on the pale blue yarn and the way the knitting needles dove in and out of the soft strands, creating every moment something that hadn't existed before. It calmed her nerves, this once ordinary morning ritual. If she loosed her thoughts, she might remember her mother sitting beside her, teaching her, saying, "Knit one, purl two. That's right. Beautiful." Or Antoine, coming down the stairs in his stockinged feet, smiling, asking her what she was making for him. Antoine. The front door opened slowly, bringing a burst of ice-cold air and a flurry of leaves. Isabel came in, wearing Antoine's old wool coat and knee-high boots and a scarf that coiled around her head and neck, obscuring all but her eyes. She saw Vian and came to a sudden stop. "Oh, you're up." She unwound the scarf and hung up her coat. There was no mistaking the guilty look on her face.
"I was out checking on the chickens."
Vian's hands stilled. The needles paused.
"You might as well tell me who he is, this boy you keep sneaking out to meet."
"Who would meet a boy in this cold?"
Isabel went to Vian, pulling her to her feet, leading her to the fire. At the sudden warmth, Vian shivered. She hadn't realized how cold she'd been.
"You," she said, surprised that it made her smile. "You would sneak out in the cold to meet a boy."
"He would have to be some boy. Clark Gable, maybe."
Sophie rushed into the room, snuggling up to Vian.
"This feels good," she said, holding her hands out.
For a beautiful, tender moment, Vian forgot her worries. And then Isabel said,
"Well, I'd best go. I need to be first in the butcher's queue."
"You need to eat something before you go," Vian said.
"Give mine to Sophie,"
Isabel answered, pulling the coat back on and rewinding the scarf around her head. Vian walked her sister to the door, watched her slip out into the darkness, then returned to the kitchen and lit an oil lamp, and went down to the cellar pantry, where rows of shelving ran along the stone wall. 2 years ago, this pantry had been full to overflowing with ham smoked in ash and jars full of duck fat set beside coils of sausage, bottles of aged champagne vinegar, tins of sardines, jars of jam. Now they were nearly to the end of the chicory coffee. The last of the sugar was a sparkly white residue in the glass container, and the flour was more precious than gold. Thank God the garden had produced a good crop of vegetables in spite of the war refugees' rampage. She had canned and preserved every single fruit and vegetable, no matter how undersized. She reached for a piece of wholemeal bread that was about to go bad. As breakfast for growing girls went, a boiled egg and a piece of toast wasn't much, but it could be worse.
"I want more," Sophie said when she'd finished.
"I can't," Vian said.
"The Germans are taking all of our food," Sophie said,
just as Beck emerged from his room, dressed in his gray-green uniform.
"Sophie,"
Vian said sharply.
"Well, it is true, young lady, that we German soldiers are taking much of the food France produces. But men who are fighting need to eat, do they not?"
Sophie frowned up at him.
"Doesn't everyone need to eat?"
"Oui, mademoiselle. And we Germans do not only take, we give back to our friends.
He reached into the pocket of his uniform and drew out a chocolate bar.
Chocolate!
Sophie, no, Vian said.
But Beck was charming her daughter, teasing her as he made the chocolate bar disappear and reappear by sleight of hand. At last, he gave it to Sophie, who squealed and ripped the paper off. Beck approached Vian.
You look sad this morning, he said quietly.
Vian didn't know how to respond. He smiled and left. Outside, she heard his motorcycle start up and putter away.
That was good chocolate, Sophie said, smacking her lips.
You know, it would have been a good idea to have a small piece each night rather than to gobble it all up at once. And I shouldn't have to mention the virtues of sharing.
Aunt Isabel says it's better to be bold than meek. She says if you jump off a cliff, at least you'll fly before you fall.
Ah, yes, that sounds like Isabel. Perhaps you should ask her about the time she broke her wrist jumping from a tree she shouldn't have been climbing in the first place. Come on, let's go to school.
Outside, they waited at the side of the muddy, icy road for Rachel and the children. Together, they set off on the long, cold walk to school.
I ran out of coffee 4 days ago, Rachel said. In case you've been wondering why I've been such a witch.
I'm the one who has been short-tempered lately, Vian said.
She waited for Rachel to disagree, but Rachel knew her well enough to know when a simple statement wasn't so simple.
It's that I've had some things on my mind.
The list. She'd written the names down weeks ago, and nothing had come of it. Still, worry lingered.
Antoine? Starvation? Freezing to death?
Rachel smiled.
What small worry has obsessed you this week?
The school bell pealed.
Hurry, Maman, we are late,
Sophie said, grabbing her by the arm, dragging her forward. Vian let herself be led up the stone steps. She and Sophie and Sarah turned into Vian's classroom, which was already filled with students.
You're late, Madame Mauriac,
Gilles said with a smile.
That's one demerit for you.
Everyone laughed. Vian took off her coat and hung it up.
You are very humorous, Gilles, as usual. Let's see if you're still smiling after our spelling test.
This time they groaned, and Vian couldn't help smiling at their crestfallen faces. They all looked so disheartened. It was difficult, honestly, to feel otherwise in this cold, blacked-out room that didn't have enough light to dispel the shadows.
Oh, what the heck! It's a cold morning. Maybe a game of tag is what we need to get our blood running.
A roar of approval filled the room. Vian barely had time to grab her coat before she was swept out of the classroom on a tide of laughing children. They had only been outside a few moments when Vian heard the grumble of automobiles coming toward the school. The children didn't notice. They only noticed aeroplanes these days, it seemed, and went on with their play. Vian walked down to the end of the building and peered around the corner. A black Mercedes-Benz roared up the dirt driveway, its fenders decorated with small swastika flags that flapped in the cold. Behind it was a French police car.
Children, Vian said, rushing back to the courtyard. Come here, stand by me.
Two men rounded the corner and came into view. One she had never seen before. He was a tall, elegant, almost effete blonde man, wearing a long black leather coat and spit-shined boots. An iron cross decorated his stand-up collar. The other man she knew. He had been a policeman in Carrivaux for years, Paul Jolaire. Antoine had often remarked that he had a mean and cowardly streak.
Madame Mauriac,
the French police officer said with an officious nod. She didn't like the look in his eyes. It reminded her of how boys sometimes looked at each other when they were about to bully a weaker child.
Bonjour, Paul.
We are here for some of your colleagues. There is nothing to concern you, madame. You are not on our list.
List.
What do you want with my colleagues?
she heard herself asking, but her voice was almost inaudible, even though the children were silent.
Some teachers will be dismissed today.
Dismissed? Why? The Nazi agent flicked his pale hand as if he were batting at a fly.
Jews and communists and Freemasons. Others, he sneered, who are no longer permitted to teach school or work in civil service or in the judiciary.
But... The Nazi nodded at the French policeman, and the two turned as one and marched into the school.
Madame Mauriac,
someone said, tugging on her sleeve.
Maman, Sophie said, whining. They can't do that, can they?
Course they can, Gilles said. Damn Nazi bastards.
Vianne should have disciplined him for his language, but she couldn't think of anything except the list of names she'd given to Beck. Vianne wrestled with her conscience for hours. She'd continued teaching for much of the day, although she couldn't remember how. All that stuck in her mind was the look Rachel had given her as she walked out of the school with the other dismissed teachers. Finally at noon, although they were already shorthanded at school, Vianne had asked another teacher to take over her classroom. Now, she stood at the edge of the town square. All the way here, she had planned what she would say, but when she saw the Nazi flag flying above the Hôtel de Ville, her resolve faltered. Everywhere she looked, there were German soldiers, walking in pairs, or riding gorgeous, well-fed horses, or darting up the streets in shiny black Citroëns. Across the square, a Nazi blew his whistle and used his rifle to force an old man to his knees.
Go, Vianne.
She walked up the stone steps to the closed oak doors, where a fresh-faced young guard stopped her and demanded to know her business.
I am here to see Captain Beck, she said.
Ah.
The guard opened the door for her and pointed up the wide stone staircase, making the number 2 with his fingers. Vianne stepped into the main room of the town hall. It was crowded with men in uniforms. She tried not to make eye contact with anyone as she hurried across the lobby to the stairs, which she ascended under the watchful eyes of the Führer, whose portrait took up much of the wall. On the second floor, she found a man in uniform, and she said to him,
Captain Beck, s'il vous plaît?
Oui, madame.
He showed her to a door at the end of the hall and rapped smartly upon it. At a response from within, he opened the door for her. Beck was seated behind an ornate black and gold desk, obviously taken from one of the grand homes in the area. Behind him, a portrait of Hitler and a collection of maps were affixed to the walls. On his desk was a typewriter and a Ronio machine. In the corner stood a pile of confiscated radios, but worst of all was the food. There were boxes and boxes of food, heaps of cured meats and wheels of cheese stacked against the back wall.
Madame Mauriac, he said, rising quickly. What a most pleasant surprise.
He came toward her.
What may I do for you?
It is about the teachers you fired at the school.
Not I, madame.
Vianne glanced at the open door behind them and took a step toward him, lowering her voice to say,
You told me the list of names was clerical in nature.
I am sorry, truly. This is what I was told.
We need them at the school.
Your being here, it is dangerous, perhaps.
He closed the small distance between them.
You do not want to draw attention to yourself, Madame Mauriac. Not here. There is a man.
He glanced at the door and stopped speaking.
Go, madame.
I wish you hadn't asked me.
As do I, madame.
He gave her an understanding look.
Now, go. Please. You should not be here.
Vianne turned away from Captain Beck, and all that food and the picture of the Führer, and left his office. On her way down the stairs, she saw how the soldiers observed her, smiling to one another, no doubt joking about another French woman courting a dashing German soldier who had just broken her heart. But it wasn't until she stepped back out into the sunshine that she realized fully her mistake. Several women were in the square or near it, and they saw her step out of the Nazis' lair. One of the women was Isabel. Vianne hurried down the steps toward Hélène Ruel, the baker's wife, who was delivering bread to the commandanteur.
"Socializing, Madame Mauriac?" Hélène said archly as Vianne rushed past her.
Isabel was practically running across the square toward her. With a defeated sigh, Vianne came to a standstill, waiting for her sister to reach her.
"What are you doing in there?"
Isabel demanded, her voice too loud, or maybe that was only to Vianne's ears.
"They fired the teachers today. No, not all of them, just the Jews and the Freemasons and the Communists."
The memory welled up in her, made her feel sick. She remembered the quiet hallway and the confusion among the teachers who remained. No one knew what to do, how to defy the Nazis.
"Just them, huh?"
Isabel said, her face tightening.
"I didn't mean it to sound that way. I meant to clarify, they didn't fire all the teachers."
Even to her own ears, it sounded a feeble excuse, so she shut up.
"And this says nothing to explain your presence at their headquarters." "I thought Captain Beck could help us, help Rachel." "You went to Beck for a favor?" "I had to." "French women do not ask Nazis for help, Vianne. Mon Dieu, you must know this." "I know," Vianne said defiantly. But what?"
Vianne couldn't hold it in anymore.
"I gave him a list of names."
Isabel went very still. For an instant, she seemed not to be breathing. The look she gave Vianne stung more than a slap across the face.
"How could you do that? Did you give him Rachel's name?" I didn't know,"
Vianne stammered.
"How could I know? He said it was clerical."
She grabbed Isabel's hand.
"Forgive me, Isabel. Truly, I didn't know."
"It is not my forgiveness you need to seek, Vianne."
Vianne felt a stinging, profound shame. How could she have been so foolish? And how in God's name could she make amends? She glanced at her wristwatch. Classes would be ending soon.
"Go to the school," Vianne said. "Get Sophie and Sarah and take them home. There's something I need to do."
"Whatever it is, I hope you've thought it through."
"Go,"
Vianne said tiredly. The Chapel of St. Jean was a small stone Norman church at the edge of town. Behind it, and within its medieval walls, lay the convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph, nuns who ran both an orphanage and a school. Vianne went into the church, her footsteps echoing on the cold stone floor, her breath plumed in front of her. She took off her mittens just long enough to touch her fingertips to the frozen holy water. She made the sign of the cross and went to an empty pew. She genuflected and then knelt. Closing her eyes, she bent her head in prayer. She needed guidance and forgiveness. But for the first time in her life, she could find no words for her prayer. How could she be forgiven for such a foolish, thoughtless act? God would see her guilt and fear, and he would judge her. She lowered her clasped hands and climbed back up to sit on the wooden pew.
"Vianne Mauriac, is that you?"
Mother Superior Marie-Thérèse moved in beside Vianne and sat down. She waited for Vianne to speak. It had always been this way between them. The first time Vianne had come to Mother for advice, Vianne had been 16 years old and pregnant. It had been Mother who comforted Vianne after Papa had called her a disgrace. Mother, who had planned for a rushed wedding and talked Papa into letting Vianne and Antoine have Le Jardin. Mother, who'd promised Vianne that a child was always a miracle and that young love could endure.
"You know there is a German billeted at my house,"
Vianne said finally.
They are at all of the big homes and in every hotel.
He asked me which of the teachers at school were Jewish or communist or Freemasons.
Ah.